Welcome to Radio Free Nintendo, episode 321. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, are James Jones.
I am a here.
Guillaume Veillette.
Hello.
And the Pokemaster himself, John Lindemann.
Back from the dead and ready to party, Johnny.
So good to have you back, John.
It's good to be back.
So for those of you who are new to the podcast...
who have started listening in the last year and a half...
who are you? That's my first question.
John is the fourth member of our regular crew, but he took a hiatus.
Yeah.
Sabbatical?
Sabbatical. That's
neither of which are words he knows.
Sabbatical is a much more professorial word for what he did. And we're very happy to have you back, John, and you're planning to be around for...
ever.
Forever show?
Forever, no. Yes. I'm actually learning how to prolong my lifespan so that it can extend hundreds, if not thousands, of years into the future.
Yeah. You went on a Christmas vacation to Transylvania.
Yep. Mm-hmm. That's exactly it. I have been transformed. I'm now a vampire.
As if you couldn't be any sexier.
You were already drinking blood, so it's just a natural evolution.
Hey, you know, it's it tastes good, you know? What can I say? It's just my flavor.
John, I know the reason you took off from the show for a while is because you were getting slammed with work, and hopefully that's better now that you've committed to being around more often and more regularly. But
let's evaluate his performance on the show before we decide if that's better. Let's see how this goes first.
Well, I mean, you let me back on the show, so I'm assuming that my past performance was at least. You know,
adequate.
Oh, you are always welcome here, John Lindemann.
Okay.
Always.
Well, you say that, Johnny. James and Gia, I don't necessarily hear a huge vote of confidence on their part. They're mostly
silent. That's my
call.
For now, for the time being, that's up to me. So yeah. I say yes. Yes. More John.
Well, I mean, at this point, my time is already well spent because I've been able to make an RG3 knee joke.
Fuck
so
you!
I've already had a chance to zing James about that one. So.
Well, you're also here to talk about games, of course. We're going to get to that in just a quick sec, but I do want to remind everyone that our predictions are coming up in the second half of the show. That was for a while, I wasn't sure if we were going to do them. I was like, does anyone listen to that? Does anyone really care? And a bunch of people came out of the woodwork and said, yes, we love the predictions. You must do the predictions. So we waited for John to come back, and we're going to do those in the second half of the episode, and that should be real stupid.
So, don't worry, it was last year.
Look forward to it. Yeah, we're gonna do a recap of last year that will be shameful. Looking forward to that. And I even have a very brief commentary from Greg Leahy on our performance from last year. So
it's
look forward
worst
to that in
the
second
today.
Segment. We're gonna kick off with new business, of course. And John, I know you probably didn't get to play as many games as you would like during your time off from the podcast. As we all have discovered, doing the podcast actually makes you play more games because you want to have something to talk about. So I'm sure you'll be getting back into it and clearing through that backlog and you know, unwrapping games and all that good stuff. But why don't you tell us about some of the games that you did get to play since you were last on the show?
Well, I mean, one of the kind of ongoing projects, you know, late to the party as usual here, but Super Mario 3D Land was one of those games where it was kind of on my, I mean, at this point I can't even really call it a pile of shame. It's more like a mountain of shame or, you know, a hall
it's
of...
It's the Mount Doom of shame.
Yeah, yes. I can't even call it like a hall of shame. It's more like a, I don't know.
Like, it's more like
shame.
A planet.
Yeah, like
made
a planet.
Made up entirely of,
you know,
games of shame.
So, yeah, and it was kind of on my, you know,
ironically, not including Katamari Damacy.
Boom! It was on the pile just because I'd played through it about halfway, you know, so I'd kind of technically beaten it, but you know, not really. Yeah. I hadn't played all
but
the way
not
through,
really.
So I powered all the way through to the end of the special worlds, and it was fun. I really enjoyed it all the way through. The only problem I had with it. I really enjoyed it up to about halfway through Special World 6. And at that point, they really started to just rehash the same things over and over again. It just felt like every single area that I played was like, you are, you know, you have to, you know, kill things to get the time clocks to extend your time. You're while being chased by, you know, Shadow Mario.
Have to get all the red coins. Do kind of start to stack things. There's one level in particular where it feels like they've put like three different horrible restrictions on you that you, and like the level's auto scrolling or some bullshit, you know, and it's at some point it feels really kind of cruel, the stuff that they're doing to you.
Or, you know, or you have to, you know, the tiles underneath you fall away as you walk across them while you're being chased by Shadow Mario, and you have to get the clocks because you're time gated. It's just after a while they just keep doing that every single time, and it's kind of like, couldn't you have thought of something new at the end of the game? You know, instead of just stacking stuff to make it harder, couldn't you have actually thought up more challenging ways to play through it? So that was a big thing with that. So I actually, it's one of those rare games where I actually liked it more probably about 3/4 of the way through than I did when I got 100% through.
Yeah, that's some old Green Star stuff from Galaxy and Galaxy 2, though. Yeah. It's like, all right, now you have to step on the platforms without stepping on one twice. Also, you're being chased by fireballs. Also, there's a time limit. Also, there's a ton of purple coins.
Yeah. Yep. I just felt like it was just, you know, it was kind of, it kind of just got to be the same thing over and over again. Now, the one question I would have for the group is it worth playing through as Luigi?
I didn't do it.
All you will do is unlock one last level, right?
Right. So the only reason to play through it as Luigi is if you're really trying to get that very last level. I've heard the last level is amazing. I'm actually still working on it myself. I'm probably about 80 or 90% of the way there. There's just a few extra, there's a couple extra worlds I have to go through as one of the characters, I don't remember, and get all the flags. But you also have to get to the top of the flagpole on every level with both characters.
Yes.
And get every star coin.
Yeah, it's brutal.
It's stupid. It's a ton of, because, I mean, I guess the goal is they want to make sure that you actually play all the levels and really master all the levels before they give you this super difficult, very final, super secret level. But they make you do it with both characters, which is super stupid because they're not that different. And so really, they're just making you do everything twice.
Well, it's like unlocking the last stage in the Galaxy games. It's just unnecessarily difficult.
I think that perhaps you're supposed to approach it more casually. I mean, maybe that seems like a contradiction since it's the game gets so hard. But at some point, someone might want to pick the game back up and try to play through it again. And then you have the option to play as Luigi. And then you have, you know, like the super secret level that few people see.
Yeah, which is exactly what I would do. If I played it again, I would play it as Luigi.
Yeah, you know? And that's kind of what I've been doing, although more in a piecemeal fashion. Like I never really stopped playing Mario 3D Land. I just kind of slowed down. Mm-hmm. So, but even now, every month or two, I'll pick it back up and play for an hour, you know, and get that much closer to unlocking that crazy final level that everybody says is so ridiculous.
Yeah,
so I'll do it eventually.
Yeah, I mean, that's why it worked for me, is because it's very good for, you know, you can play it for an hour or so and, you know, maybe you'll beat a few areas and, you know, just go about your day kind of thing. I think I only have a couple of star coins to get. There's a couple I wasn't able to get on my first way through. I typically did try to get all three, but some of them, it was just, I was just beating my head against a wall and I just moved on.
That's the thing about the game, though, because it would be good to have a warning beforehand when you're playing as Mario that you probably shouldn't try to get all the coins the first time, or that you shouldn't start over a level because you didn't, because you're going to have to start over anyway, eventually, if you play as Luigi.
So the coin count completely resets as Luigi?
No, it doesn't.
Okay,
instead of, if you don't know about the Luigi stuff, some people, like myself, will end up playing through levels three times instead of two.
Yeah.
So it's even more work.
Or four times instead of two.
Yeah, Mario and Luigi share coins, and some of them might be a little bit easier to get with Luigi.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
Or if you're going to play through the whole game again as Luigi, you might as well wait to clean up the star coins, because you're going to play through that level again anyway.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I wouldn't have tried so hard to get all those coins. If I would have known, I would have had to go literally all the way through every single place, every single area with Luigi. So So, yeah, but I mean, I enjoyed that, and, you know, now I'm kind of, my 3DS, I'm kind of wondering what to do with it. I have a hankering for New Super Mario Bros. 2. I have a hankering. a burning desire in my soul to get New Super Mario Bros. 2, so that's probably going to happen sometime soon. I'm just kind of in the mood for a 2D sort of Mario game, and, you know, I love having them on the handheld so I can, you know, just pick them up and put them down whenever.
Okay, well, so. I was gonna just about to ask, because I feel strongly, and I don't think many people will argue with this, that Mario U is better than Mario 2 on 3DS, but you don't have a Wii U yet, do you?
No, I don't have a Wii U right now, and I'm probably not going to be getting one for a while. I might get one in March, maybe around Monster Hunter time. I'm not sure. But
okay, I was going to ask, what do you think is the killer title that would push you over the edge?
I don't know. Monster Hunter, maybe, but from what I'm hearing about Monster Hunter, it sounds sort of like really
Monster
not
Hunter?
Too much. Yeah, I mean, it's Monster Hunter, but I mean, it's not really too much of an upgrade over the original Try. So
no, it's just Monster Hunter again.
Yeah.
It's like Try plus plus.
Yeah.
It's like Try plus. Yeah, I mean, it's the most ridiculous porting scheme I've ever heard. Mm-hmm. It is the most Capcomist game ever.
Yeah.
Well, they did improve it when they put it on 3DS, and then they did improve it when they put that version on Wii U.
I know. Yeah. But it's still as Capcom-y as you could be about porting stuff.
But it's still Monster Hunter 3, which you've played a shit ton of on Wii.
Yeah. Now, I do have it pre-ordered for 3DS, but the thing is with 3DS, it really kind of burned me to learn that you weren't going to be able to play online. That kind of burned me.
That is weird and unnecessary because the system supports online. There's no reason to dick out of it. I mean,
it does really well.
The reason is because Japan people wouldn't have used it anyway.
Yeah,
I guess. But
so the reason they make the console versions online is because you can't do like local multiplayer on a console.
Yeah.
So if you're going to play multiplayer at all on a console, it has to be online.
Yeah.
So they support it with online, but the portable games in Japan, they're so popular to just get together and play them over wireless locally that for Capcom, it's not really worth the effort to make them online.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, though. I really don't want to – I'm never going to probably find anybody in my area to play that game with.
No.
So it just makes it – I don't know. It's not nearly as appealing as it would be if I could just go online, see who's online playing Monster Hunter on my 3DS, and just hop on. That would be amazing. I would play the hell out of that game. So, yeah. I mean, so I'm not too sure exactly when I'm going to get a Wii U. I mean, it's in the plans. It's just a question of when. I also kind of might wait until E3 to see if Nintendo sort of drops the price at all. And the reason why I say that is because, you know, $350 for the one that I'm going to get, I don't know if they're going to drop the basic one or what. I'm just not too sure. I don't think that their pricing is completely what they want right now. So I think they might do something with that. At E3.
Yeah. Well, maybe we'll have a prediction on that topic later.
Possibly.
On the show.
Possibly. I kind of walked into that inadvertently, but that was not.
I predict John walked into that inadvertently.
My God, you're a
fortune
teller.
I don't think you know
what
predict means, yeah. James.
James can see the future.
So, John, what else have you been playing lately?
I've also been playing Black Ops 2. Put it down for a little while, kind of over Christmas. I haven't played too much, but. At first, I was, you know, because I did wind up getting both Halo 4 and Black Ops 2, and I was kind of curious to see. I was originally going to only get one or the other, but, you know, hey, whatever. It's me. So I got Black Ops 2, and it's interesting. It's actually, I really didn't like the first Black Ops. I just really didn't think it was that great. I didn't play it online very much at all. And it just really didn't impress me. I didn't like the guns. I didn't really care too much about the whole 1960s thing. You know, I like more of the more like futuristic, like leaning more towards like Halo style guns, or stuff that's kind of like near future sort of stuff like that. So because I was a big fan of Modern Warfare 2, Modern Warfare 3. So I picked up Black Ops kind of, you know, I think. To me, probably they were doing. I figured that they were doing enough stuff that seemed, you know, kind of forward thinking or interesting, like kind of like they have like the league mode in there. So I figured that they were doing enough stuff that I would give it a chance, and it was getting some pretty good reviews. I mean, I expect games like this in these long running franchises to typically get, you know, 8.5s or 8s or whatever, and I don't expect anybody to be like, oh my God, this is the most amazing thing ever, because, you know, over time, you have various camps that just, you know, kind of learn to hate any certain long-standing franchise, and then you have certain camps that completely love it. So it's kind of, over time, it gets harder and harder to actually get an unbiased look at any franchise like this.
I think it becomes difficult to review the games individually because there's only going to be so much change between them, and after a certain number of years, some reviewers just get kind of meh about them.
Yeah.
And then there are people who are so ingrained in the game that it's like, oh, it's great, it's the best game ever, regardless of the individual game's merits.
But yeah, so with Black Ops 2, the story is, I don't know, there's a bad guy, he's a terrorist, he kills people, I don't know, you go all over the world, it's nothing new. But what I did like about the campaign was the strike team parts of it, where this was something where it was completely confusing to me when I first played it. But you have a choice between sort of moving around your various men on the field kind of thing. Like you command a strike team, and you can also command like the vehicles that they use. They have like these little things called claws, which are kind of like mini AT-AT walkers that, you know, you can put on the ground, and they can march forward and shoot down enemy troops and stuff. And so you have various little, like, you know, kind of vehicles like that you can deploy, you know, to take out enemy forces. And you can do that from an overhead grid. So this kind of has sort of a, you know, real-time strategy element to it. But the cool thing is that you can also zoom in to a first-person view, and actually you can take command of pretty much anything on the field, including these claw units, including, you know, your actual troops. So it's pretty cool because you can, if your troops aren't doing very well in one area, then you can jump down and take control of, you know, one of the guys to, you know, start taking out the enemy on your own, which is really, really neat. And so the first time I played one of those, I was like, I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I was getting my butt kicked. But as I became more adept at them, I actually enjoyed it. That was what I enjoyed most in the campaign, you know, because, you know, for the first person shooting part of it, it's really kind of, you know, it's pretty much the same. It's a lot, just waves and waves of enemies, you know, some set pieces, you know, boom, you know.
Stuff blow up,
people
shot.
Get killed. Yep, you know, everything is very epic. Black Ops is, the movement in the last couple of games has been towards more and more kind of epic set pieces that look good on TV. You know, like guys jumping out of a plane and diving and, you know, planes blowing up below them, and, you know, fire flying by them. Yeah. A lot of that stuff. It's just a lot of the stuff in it now is very, very impactful, you know? So it's sort of like by the end of the game, you're just like, all right, you just want to put down the joystick and go and sit in a quiet corner. But, you know, what impressed me about that is the fact that they actually did change something up and do something different and new. It's actually the first time I've seen that in a first-person shooter for a long time, where there's been legitimately something new in the campaign. And there's also branching areas of the campaign. So it's pretty cool. You know, it gives some replay value and kind of, you know, makes it more than just a ho-hum. I'm going to, you know, play straight through, you know, on, you know, normal, heroic, whatever, and then you'll be done with the campaign forever. So there is some replay value there, which I thought was pretty cool. In terms of online, they added the league stuff, which is, you know, you can, you know, kind of play through, you know, you are given, it's sort of like with StarCraft, where you play a couple of matches up front to kind of see where your skill level is at. They place you in a certain group, and then you move up the ranking based on, you know, victories and kills and stuff like that. So that's pretty neat. You know, it's something new. It kind of gives you more reason to play through the title to kind of get, you know, kind of a league ranking, more so than just, you know, I always found it, you know, just trying to rank up in prestige and all that kind of stuff. After a while, it's kind of brainless. Like you're literally doing the same thing over and over again, unless you switch game modes and stuff like that. But if you skew more towards being competitive rather than just kind of wanting like sort of mayhem and having a good time, that's probably like more Halo 4 to me. You know, because, you know, Black Ops 2 is you can tell over time that it's becoming more and more esports focused. It's getting more and more streamlined, and it's kind of cut and dry. Every game mode is, you know, there's a clear cut winner. You know, and it's very stats based and stuff like that. Whereas Halo 4, I think, is kind of more.
I'm still excited to play Black Ops 2 on Wii U. I'm obviously not in a huge hurry to do that. The Wii U version may not be the strictly best version, but I think it's at least competitive in terms of tech to maybe be the best version. You know, I think it's at least arguable. It's certainly not the worst version. It's certainly not clearly worse than other versions. And, you know, I like the features that they added for the Wii U version. I like the stuff they're doing with it. And I'm not a great first-person shooter player, you know? So, like, to me, being able to play in a little bit friendlier online community, you know, with people who are not as crazy, you know, like the lack of the super hardcore player base on Wii U is an advantage for that version to me.
Yep.
Because I don't think I don't think the player matching in terms of skill level works in Call of Duty. In my experience on Xbox, it does not work.
Oh no, it doesn't.
And I don't think it works really in any game. I've never seen a game that does that well, but it definitely doesn't work in Call of Duty. And even on Xbox, where there is no shortage of Call of Duty players online, they will still pair you up with someone who is 100 times better than you and will just kill you every single time they see you. And that sucks.
Yeah, I mean, Black Ops 2, to me, I mean, when I first started playing it, because I was like, and by the time I stopped playing Modern Warfare 3, I was at the point where I could go online and I could have fun pretty much every time. Like, you know, I was pretty much like one for one. You know, a typical match for me would be like, you know, 15 kills, 15 deaths, which is fine. That's not bad. Yeah, Black Ops 2, dude, when I first started playing that, oh my God, I was getting waxed. I mean, we're talking like 2 kills, 21 deaths, 4 kills, 18 deaths. I mean, to the point where I almost quit. I was just like, this is way too hard. The matchmaking is just screwy. And I just really didn't feel that even as I played more and more, I never got a feel for exactly what I should be doing or how I should build out my guy or anything like that. It was just really tough. Mm-hmm. So.
Was it that you got better as you played it more, or just that you gained enough experience from putting a certain amount of time into it that you unlocked the better gear and perks that made you more competitive?
Well, the thing is, like Black Ops 2, they have this, like the they call it pick 10, where you can pretty much mix and match any 10 perks, like guns or perks, whatever. So that makes it almost harder, because it's harder to find out what a good build is, you know, in terms of what you can use. So I had to kind of do some research to find out sort of what works with what guns, like what's effective. Like, it's just tough. Like, you kind of have to like really do some research. So that's really what helped me. I can't really say that I don't think I got any better at the game. I just used my guns in a smarter fashion.
See, to me though, that's, I find that really disheartening that it, that you being able to get good at the game really had not much to do with your personal progression as it did with just finding the right reward for having played the game a lot.
Yeah. I feel like the series has always been like that to a degree. It's always been like, hey, well, once you get this gun, then you're going to really start screwing people over, right?
All right. Well, anyway, there will probably be more Call of Duty talk eventually. But anyway, Guillaume, why don't you go next with new business?
All right. So over the holidays, I know that I said in an earlier episode that I didn't want to get Paper Mario Sticker Star yet because I wanted to get rid of the Paper Mario game that I already own and haven't started yet. But I saw a deal, Paper Mario for $30, and I thought, well, deals on Nintendo games at retail, they don't come by that often. I had it with me over the holidays, and, you know, it was easier to start playing that than to start playing Super Paper Mario. So I've been playing for like 15 hours now, Paper Mario Sticker Star. And I am enjoying the game, but I do have some issues with it. When I had previewed it at that Nintendo event, I had been really, you know, I fell in love with the dialogue, and I really liked the idea that the fights were more or less optional, that you could avoid them and that there would be little to no consequences. Turns out in the full game, the dialogue is still really charming and really, really funny, and I do think it's the strongest that the dialogue in the series has ever been. But the whole battle aspect hasn't really turned out the way I thought it would. Because fights initially are easy to avoid, but then they get progressively harder. And at some point, you're still always stuck getting into fights. Or maybe I'm just not very good at avoiding enemies. But, you know, when you're trying to explore an area, you do have to slow down a little bit. And so that's when the enemies get you. So initially, in your first run in an area, you're always going to get into pretty much every fight. And then it turns out that since you're not really gaining experience points, you're not really earning anything from those fights, and I don't think it really makes it worse than previous Paper Mario games, but it, you know, I'm not really enjoying it at all.
It takes something away from the reward system in the battles, I would think.
Like, yeah.
It just feels like pretty much any battle that's not against the boss at that point just feels superfluous. Like, there's nothing gained by carrying this battle out.
That is true.
To an extent.
You gain money, but you don't really need money.
More money, more problems.
I do enjoy the whole aspect of exploring the different areas, and actually probably, I wouldn't have expected that, but one of my favorite things to do right now is to find the secret doors and going back to previous areas and, you know, putting the secret door stickers at the right places and finding new items all over the place. And in a way, that's where the reward system is. Like, for me, the dialogue is what I really like about the game. And every time you find an item, you can put it in the sticker museum where you can get a funny description for each and every one of those items. So, actually, you know, like, not only do I enjoy the act of exploring each area, but I also enjoy the reward you get for it.
That it's interesting that you consider the description the reward, because I stopped reading them pretty quickly because maybe just the first few that I put in there, I read the descriptions and I wasn't very intrigued by them. And I was hoping that you would get like a really detailed description of what the sticker does when you use it.
That would be nice. You
solve puzzles and beat bosses and, you know, use the, especially for the things, you know, like the vacuum cleaners and the baseball bats and all the weird stuff that you find everywhere. Because those stickers are used to solve puzzles and beat bosses and do really important things. Mm-hmm. And the uses are often not very obvious. And if you're going to put one in the sticker museum, you're really giving up a lot when you go in that museum and put a sticker in, because it's going to cost you something to get that sticker back. So you put it in the museum, you are consuming that copy of the sticker, and now you're either going to have to go back to the level where you found it and get the thing all over again, or you have to go to the store and pay a bunch of money to buy it back. So to me, I got to the point where I was going to the museum just compulsively because I felt like I should fill it up. I should put every unique sticker I find in the museum because there must be a good reason. And I finally looked on GameFAQs and found out you don't really get anything for filling up the museum. And I definitely didn't feel like the per sticker reward for doing so wasn't what it should be.
Well, to me, I think that it works out nicely, because what happens is I do have some items that I end up picking up over and over again because I am going back to old areas to find new things. So what happens is that I'm getting items that I've already donated to the museum. So those stickers I can use in boss battles. And the new items that I get, I just donate to the museum again. And I don't really need them because my sticker book is already full. And I do agree that I wish that the description for these items told you what to do with them. Because there are some items that are actually very powerful, but you actually have to do something to make them work. For instance, there's going to be like a red balloon that you get, and you have to tap A to make it explode. The chances are that you're going to lose it in the first battle, and you're not going to inflate it because you're not going to know that you were supposed to do that. But eventually you figure it out. So I do wish, you know, that they would tell you how to work them, but at the same time, I also appreciate the kind of little description that they give you. You know, the fact that a team of toad scientists got stuck doing friction tests on the balloon is pretty damn funny.
I feel like Sticker Star, to me, the Mario and Luigi series on GBA and DS is actually funny, like laugh out loud funny. And the Paper Mario franchise is more like when my mom goes to see some kind of, you know, shitty romantic comedy in the theater, you know, she'll come out of it and I'll say, "Mom, I say, "Mom, was it any good?" And she'll say, "It was cute," which means that she was kind of entertained by it, but like, you know, didn't really have anything notable to say about it. And that's how I feel about the Paper Mario series. Like, it's cute, it's charming, but it's not actually funny.
Yeah, and I've always found that that was one of the reasons why I always preferred the Mario and Luigi series over Paper Mario. I thought that the previous Paper Mario games were really, like, sometimes, occasionally, they would make me smile, and the Mario and Luigi series would actually make me laugh out loud. But in this one, you know, I'm not really laughing out loud all that much, but I do think that the writing has improved and has gotten funnier. And, you know, like, the game makes me smile, so I don't know. That's something.
Yeah, it is a charming game. I mean, I would say the visual style is much more effective than the writing for me. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just seeing, like, a Toad all being, you know, looking distraught, just shaking his arms, flaying, and you go talk to him, and he's like, oh, there's a new shop that opened, did you see it? It looks so much fun, you know, and it's just, yeah, that kind of shit makes me smile. So I'm not loving the game, but I keep playing it. I do think it's worth my time so far, and I guess I'm going to keep playing it until I feel otherwise, but It's a cute game. So I've been playing that, but I've also, for I don't know why I got this game. I got this DSiWare.
Strong start.
Hmm? Yeah, I know.
Did you pay for this?
I did. Okay.
You're buying brand new DSiWare games in 2013.
They're still coming out, that. Man.
Look, I have no idea why I buy the stuff I buy. It's still a mystery. Maybe scientists one day will figure it out. But right now, who knows what makes me choose what I choose to play? I have no idea. I've bought this DSiWare game called Galaxy Saver. And perhaps I was emboldened by another $2 eShop game that I bought that we're going to talk about later. That turned out to be actually good. Perhaps I saw that there were no reviews on Metacritic, and I was like, hey, maybe I can write something for the site.
Maybe you'll be famous.
you keep telling yourself that if it lets you sleep at night.
Yeah. And I watched a video. I thought it looked okay, and I was feeling, you know, in the mood for a shooter. So I got Galaxy Saver. It was just $2. It's this
the two worst dollars you've ever spent.
Well, no. Well, the thing is, like, the game is not offensively bad. It's just mediocre. And I
that's good.
Let me explain. Okay, so you have this ship, and you are defending this base, and you are on the outside of this base that's circular, and so you have to fend off attacks from, you know, 360 degrees. You move on its surface, and, like, attacks can come from everywhere. And so you shoot down waves of enemies for a certain time, for, like, 60, 90, or 180 seconds. Or you can also have a activate a shield and protect the base that way. You can just, like, let the enemies run into you, activate your shield, and you're not gonna blow up, and you're gonna have, you know, save the base from an attack. The thing is, though, like, the game, I think, would be fine, but it's really made in a way that has you grind. Because as you play the game, you've got a tree of missions, and you've got, like, A1, B1, C1, and you can also, you know, have a branching path, and you can take B2 instead of B1, and it's going to be a slightly harder mission, right? But also, as you shoot down enemies and you earn ranks, from, you know, D to S, you gain points. And as you gain points, you gain ranks. As you gain ranks, you can unlock, other ships that assist you. And those ships are necessary to complete some of the other missions, like the harder missions. You cannot even attempt them, without leveling up, basically, and getting these upgrades. And so that really rewards grinding more than it rewards getting better at the game. And I really can't stand that stuff in this kind of, you know, arcadey shooter. Like, if you're going to make me play a game for a high score, I better improve that high score by getting better at the game, and not because I spent enough time on it that I got this upgrade that actually allows me to you know, to face the challenges that you throw at me. Mm-hmm. So it's really, I don't know, like, it's disappointing. I find that there's a lot of these cheap shooters that use that kind of mechanic to kind of prolong the longevity of the game, and it's really not all that fun. Actually, like, one of the early missions, if you choose the harder path, you have to destroy these asteroids crashing into the base. And I've tried with my non-upgraded ship, and it's absolutely impossible to win. At some point at the end of the mission, there's this giant asteroid that's bigger than the base you're defending. It's coming down, it's crashing on you, and shoot as much as you want, you're not going to destroy it. And if you earn the first upgrade and you go back, then you have a chance. Then you can actually, really, like, the mission is impossible unless you've upgraded, unless you've spent about, like, an hour trying to get the first upgrade. And, you know, like, when you have to unlock the fun in a game, like, clearly the game is doing it wrong. But, yeah, like, so I don't recommend the game. It's...
You don't really have to not recommend DSiWare.
Because no one's going to play it anyway.
That's right.
I don't know. I've got a lot of, you know, old DSiWare games. I guess that perhaps the good stuff was more early on, back when studios were working on them.
The developers who were making the really good DSiWare games have long since moved on to Steam and 3DS eShop and other things.
This is from G-Style, which I think had, you know, like, some of their games had got some good word of mouth. Like, they usually develop these, like, some of the cheaper DSiWare games, and a lot of people found them at least adequate. Like, I remember hearing good about, you know, the GG series or whatever it's called.
Yeah, they're just because they publish some of the GG series, develop some of them, don't take it too far, because they aren't all have the same developers.
Right.
I didn't know that.
Some of the games that are Go series were actually rebranded as GG series in the U.S. for some reason.
Because, you know, brand recognition.
But there's still Go series games out there, too.
The famous GG series. All right, well, you know, I learned my lesson. The game looked like, there's nothing really offensively bad about the game except for its, you know, some basic design problems. But otherwise, it looks fine. It's just, you know, not very fun.
That's a killer. All right, so James is up next with new business.
Sort of. Yeah, so I have played a bit of a Steam game I picked up during the Steam sale. I actually tweeted about it about 2 weeks ago, which is a game we've talked about on the show before called To the Moon, which is, I guess it's an adventure game in the old terminology of the term, but now referred to more as a point-and-click adventure game. But really, it's a game in which all the gameplay is more or less just a means to an end. And the end is to tell you this story about two doctors whose job it is, not medical doctors. I guess they're psychologists or PhDs, I'm not sure. But their job is to go back. Essentially, they come to someone who is dying on their deathbed and have a device that allows them to enter the person's mind or enter their dreams, whatever. And they essentially create memories in your head that you don't actually have as sort of a last wish for these people. So they need to do research on the individuals in order to construct an appropriate memory. And in the case of the one that this story centers on, the request is quite simple. The individual wants to go to the moon. That's it. That's the whole request they get. And when they attempt to pry to find out more about why this is what he wants, he refuses to provide or is unable to provide additional details as to why this is what he desires. The majority of the game takes place essentially slowly hopping back through his memories until they reach the point where they can A, create the memory he wants, and B, have enough information to understand why it is he wants to do it and what details they need to have in order to make it doable. What the game really does, though, is it presents you a story that attempts to tell you the history of this one individual, the relatively difficult life that he's lived, but in reverse. So you basically are watching him reverse age until the point where you sort of see his relationship with his, I guess it was his wife, go from essentially her death all the way back to very early on in their relationship. It's sort of like, it's a very touching experience in the same way that sort of the opening sequences of Up are touching. It's kind of the same sort of vibe. Yeah.
No, it is. James, I love this game when I played it a few months ago, and I bet that you loved it too.
I did. I haven't quite finished it yet. I'm very near the end.
Oh. It's really short, though. It's like 5 hours long.
Yeah, it is. It's super short.
And it looks like Chrono Trigger.
It does look a lot like it looks like a Super Nintendo RPG of a Square Enix make. Yes.
In the best way possible. Yeah.
So you're near the end, or should you rather say you're near the beginning?
Yeah.
Maybe. It's true. It's just a very delightful is not the word, because it's a very somber mood to the game. There are moments where it feels really, you know, there's really touching moments, but there's just moments of the game where you feel very like, oh man. That's the moment where you realize that not only, I mean, you know she's dead, that's revealed to you very early in the game, but the moment where you realize that you're more or less intruding on the act of her dying, or the moments where her death is coming up, are particularly upsetting, that's probably the word for it. It's just, it's a very well-written, well-experienced, well-put-together game that is incredibly capable of giving you an emotional journey or putting you emotionally vested in relatively, I mean, characters you never play as. The doctors, I mean, you become somewhat invested in them too as they react to the same thing you're seeing. But really, it's the characters you're not playing at that really matter to you as the story progresses on, retrogresses on, I guess. It's a very tightly wound plot that just feels really good to play. Gameplay wise, there's not a lot to it. I mean, it's the game. Like I said, the gameplay is a means to an end.
Mm-hmm.
But what it does do is really impressive, and it's a great example of telling the story of a game without getting crazy overboard, and understanding that you can have a story that is very tightly focused, doesn't need to be big, explosive, or whiz-bang story time. A really tight, small story that can be much more impacting than anything you can do by having a giant set piece blow up.
Well, I think the story has... I think that's a great concept. I mean, when you tell me, yeah, they're intruding on... They're implanting stuff in people's heads to make them think that they had a life that they never actually lived, that's a pretty cool concept. Like, that's a concept that you could actually wrap a feature film around, you know?
You could.
That's really cool.
It is similar to Inception or... Mm-hmm.
It's the anti-Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Yes.
There you go.
Yeah, yep. It's very similar to that. But you know, I think one thing I really like about it is that the tone of the story fits with the graphic style. Because I feel like even though this is a modern game, it looks like a 16-bit game. And the way they tell the story through the text and through, you know, the style of the writing and the style of the graphics, it is in some ways, it does evoke the kinds of mini stories that you would get in 16-bit RPGs. So you've got these very tender moments in a game like Chrono Trigger where you learn about Luca's mother and what happened to her, and you have a chance to do something about it. If that's your favorite part of Chrono Trigger, you will adore To the Moon, because it's sort of taking a moment like that that's very powerful in a much grander RPG with lots of fighting and crazy sci-fi monsters and stuff, and it's saying, what if we made the whole game around this moment? And what if we explored? And it's not doing anything that Chrono Trigger couldn't have done. You know, in terms of not only just technologically, but in terms of the writing and the music and the whole presentation, it feels like this is very much made like a 16-bit RPG. But what if we took out all the battles and we expanded some of these sort of story moments that were so impactful in a very reduced form back then?
There is one thing they couldn't have done, though, in Chrono Trigger, and that is they couldn't have allowed you to be unable to change the ultimate destiny of, in this case, Luca's mother.
Hmm.
Because in that game, you're actually time traveling. If they copped out and said, but you can't fix it, I think it would have lost some of the impact. But in this, you're not traveling through time. You're just watching this person's memories. There's nothing you can do to stop it. You can't even really provide comfort to this guy as he's suffering. It's just, this has all already happened. So you're just sort of stuck watching and just watching it unfold and going and realizing the inevitability of what you're watching. I think makes it feel even more, I don't want to say horrible, because it's not bad. It's just more of an intense feeling. Because at least in the case of Luca's mother, you go, I can do something about this. I'm the best.
Well, but keep in mind, though, for a lot of people, the first time they played Chrono Trigger, they were not able to save Luca's mother. And they might not have even known that it was possible to save her. So I think a lot of people still had that feeling of helplessness. It's I watched this happen, but I couldn't stop it. And that makes it even more emotional and stressful.
It's a remarkably well-written game. It really is. I mean, it's
and the
it's
music
not...
is so good.
It is really good music.
I just think that stories like this, I think they're actually better told for me with like these 16-bit style graphics, because I feel like kind of like as you're viewing the game unfold, I feel like I get more invested in these characters, or I have to bring more to the experience than I do, you know, with something that's, you know, like James said, some whiz-bang sort of Cage's...
Heavy Rain.
Yes, Heavy Rain. See, stuff like that, I can't see myself getting as involved in those characters because I feel like it's more one-sided. Like, I feel like I'm watching the story unfold rather...
Right.
I don't get invested in the characters as much as I would a 16-bit RPG, like, you know, Chrono Trigger, for example.
It's because they're trying to do it at a really high fidelity level, and they don't get there.
Yeah.
A lot of these 16-bit RPGs and To the Moon, which is really in a different... It's really not a 16-bit RPG, but it feels like one. The 16-bit art style and the music that they use, the character designs and the kind of animation that they pull off, it's just enough to tell the story. So, like, you couldn't really do this with 8-bit because the characters don't animate well enough to really show emotion.
Yeah.
But you can't really do it with 32-bit because they animate too well and now the emotions look fake. And you don't have to use your imagination enough. So 16-bit is really a nice compromise where they can tell a nuanced story and yet leave enough gaps that you actually have to fill it in with your own imagination, which makes it feel more personal to you.
Exactly. Like in something like Heavy Rain, I feel like they're telling you what to experience.
Yeah.
Oh,
well, they are.
Yeah, they are.
They're instructing you.
You have to have sprites that can look down at their feet and look sad.
Mm-hmm. True.
That's
which
what
is
you
hard
need.
To do in 8-bit. Yeah.
But and Heavy Rain wasn't really helped by the fact that, you know, what was the setting again? Boston or Chicago? And no one had American accents. Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. Like, the more you raise those stakes, the higher expectations the audience has. And then when you miss those kinds of crucial details, like, wait a minute, all these people have weird Canadian accents. And that kind of thing really breaks the experience.
Yeah.
Well, that's not a problem. You can't even have that problem in a 16-bit game. It's just beyond the scope of what you're doing.
Implying that the people in Heavy Rain had Canadian accents is a little bit insulting. I'm sorry.
I think they did. I think they hired some French-Canadian actors, didn't they?
They're based in Europe. David Cage is French.
I was thinking of... sorry, I might be getting confused with some of the Ubisoft games.
I mean, if it was Canadian voice acted and it was a game, it probably came out of Vancouver, to be honest. Hmm. There's a couple different VA shops there, but
Heavy Rain with Michael Ironside as the detective. I want that.
So I'm gonna wrap up new business with starting with Gunman Clive, which is a 3DS eShop game. It just came out a week ago, and it cost $2. $2, and it is so much better than you would ever expect for a $2 eShop game.
I bet better than Guillaume expects.
Oh, man.
Well, I've played this. You. It's really good. It's probably what emboldened me to try Galaxy Saber.
You're like, hey, I got $2 for the highest bidder right here.
You win some, you lose some.
Yeah.
But if you pay $2 to download Gunman Clive on your 3DS, you have won. Because it is a really, really cool game. It's not that long. So I think the $2 price, although I think it's a very good value, I think it's you know, kind of a steal at $2. I mm-hmm. think you can understand that it would be that cheap because it's a pretty short game. You can play through the whole thing in maybe an hour, maybe 2 hours if you play some of the extra modes or if you get stuck and have to keep trying a level or two. But for the most part, it's a short game, but it is so high quality that that's the shocking part. You're like, wait a minute. How did I get away with only paying $2 for this? Because it is so well made. The graphic style is superb and it looks so good in 3D. It feels like a while since I played a 3DS game where I felt that the 3D added so much to it. And it's a 2D platformer. I mean, it's basically Mega Man with a different graphic style.
Yeah.
And yet the 3D, and maybe it's because the art style is so simple that the 3D calls more attention to itself, but I think it looks so good. And I tried turning the slider off and it doesn't look nearly as good. So this is a game, if you really want a game that uses 3D well, it doesn't affect the gameplay whatsoever. It just makes it look way more awesome. Gunman Clive is a super cheap way to get a lot of value out of that feature. And the game controls perfectly. I understand this started as an iPhone game, which makes me cry on the inside. I mean, that is so awful to imagine playing this game with some kind of touchscreen D-pad thing. Because this game is a Mega Man game. I mean, it's hard. It's very exacting. It requires very precise control and very good timing. And when you're playing with a D-pad and buttons, it feels exactly like it should. It feels like Mutant Muds. It feels like the original Mega Man. And it does exactly what you want it to do. And that's a large part of what makes the game fun and satisfying to play. So you take that away, and I'm not sure I'm not sure I could recommend this at all on a platform that doesn't have a D-pad and buttons. But with it, it's great.
But what if it's $1? What if it's free?
Even then, no. I mean, you can change. You can put the price. You can put the price at whatever you want. It doesn't make it fun. So I mean, and you know, once you start reducing the price from $2, you really hit diminishing returns there. Anyway, it's already so cheap that it's kind of an afterthought to even pay for it. Yeah. And the music is wonderful. The characters are really funny looking. The gameplay is great. The bosses are really good, and there's lots of really cool power ups you get. And the game, it really does feel like every level in the game is different. They really don't reuse ideas. They remix them a little bit just to give you a different challenge, but it feels like the game never repeats itself. It introduces some kind of platform or some kind of enemy, and it throws it at you in one or two different ways, and then once it's kind of used that, it throws it away and it moves on to something different.
Yeah, you get hints of Donkey Kong Country in there. And you do get, like, the game really wears its inspiration on its sleeve with Mega Man, because you get a couple of types of stage directly lifted from Mega Man. You know, yes. Like a combination of an Airman stage and Electman. And you've got even, what did you call them again? The vacuum tubes or vacuum squares?
Yeah, from Iceman in the first
game. Yeah, that disappear beneath your feet and... But that's just like one section, you know, and another stage would be completely different.
Yeah, and there's the touchscreen doesn't really do anything. They don't use it for much, but it shows like a very crude map of the level system. And every fifth level is a boss level. And the symbol for the boss level on the map is the same skull that they use in Mega Man on NES. So that's how much Mega Man Gunman Clive really is. It is super, super, super Mega Man. And it's fantastic. The art, I really can't stress, the art style is so good. It looks incredible, but it plays like something you are definitely familiar with, and it plays super tight, and it's really fun. It's challenging, but not super frustrating, you know? It's not annoyingly hard. It's just challenging enough that you want to keep playing it, and there's no limited lives or anything like that. And there's also not really any secrets in the game.
No.
And I feel like for a $2 game, I'm not going to complain about that. Okay. I think the amount of content in here is totally great for the price of the game. But I also felt like I was playing through the game that the lack of secrets, you know, that not feeling the need to constantly stop and look around and see if there might be something I'm missing was actually kind of nice. Like once I felt comfortable that I wasn't missing anything as I just plowed through these levels, it let me focus on just getting to the end. And that is the goal of the game, is just get to the end of the level. Kill the dudes that are in your way, ignore the ones that you can, and just keep moving, because that's hard enough. And once you kind of realize that, it's very pure. It's a very, very nice feeling to just say, I'm just going to keep moving straight through this, and I don't have to worry about exploring.
Yeah, and the character that you unlock when you beat the game once, it really changes up the way that you go through the levels. The physics are a little bit different, and you have to move a different way through the levels. I don't want to spoil it, but it's pretty cool.
There's surprisingly good replay value even. Yeah. So Gundam Clive is a game that I can very easily recommend to anyone who has a 3DS. Very easy recommend. I will pick it up. Yeah. And then the other game I played this week, I started and finished the story mode in 1 week, and that's Halo 4. And that is one thing I really like about it, is that Halo 4's campaign is about 6 or 7 hours long. It's long enough to not feel like a total jip, but it's short enough to feel like you can actually finish it. And it feels digestible, and that is an admirable quality.
Yep.
Now, so, Johnny, do you read the Halo books? Are you well-versed in Halo lore?
You know, the funny thing is, this is only the second Halo game I've really played through, and the first was Halo Reach. So this is actually, outside of, like, I spent like maybe 10 minutes once playing the very first Halo on Xbox, and I didn't like it, really, what I played, the single player part. But aside from that, this is the first time I've played as Master Chief. So I didn't know that he had a voice.
Yeah, they added that in as they went along, really. They tried to... The thing is, basically, when it first started off, he was kind of...
The mute hero.
Laughed at, because he was such a...
Oh, he's not a great character. No. Don't get me wrong.
His name is Master Chief, for God's sake.
It's awful, but what I will say about Halo 4, though, is that I did like the fact... I feel like it's a much less... All that Space Marine hoo-ah kind of bullshit that's in the first couple of Halos that I absolutely could not stand. Like, you know, like the guy, like the grunts around you just saying the most hokey crap. None of that stuff. This is more like Halo Reach, where it's kind of more focused on like being more of kind of like a serious story. Like, you know, not just some kind of like Space Marine fantasy kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So.
And, you know, I have to admit that the, although Master Chief himself is not terribly interesting personality wise. Yeah. He doesn't really have very much personality. But the AI that he carries around, who talks to him constantly, Cortana, she's a fairly interesting character. She's kind of an evolution of Navi from Ocarina of Time. It's like and it's funny to think that the first Halo came out in 2001. I don't really know what Cortana was like in that game, because I didn't really even get that far when I played the first game.
Yeah.
But even, you know, 3 years after Ocarina of Time came out, this character was conceived, and it's the idea that what if we took Navi and we made her intelligent and actually have conversations with the main character as you play through the game. So she helps you, and she tells you where to go next, but she also has a personality, and she also actually is kind of talking as you play the game. She's not stopping and making you read text. She's talking to you while you shoot dudes. Mm-hmm. And she is a very sympathetic character, and the acting is very good. The character design is very good. And in this game, because Master Chief does talk, they actually have conversations, and they have this kind of relationship that develops over the course of the game. And she's going through this thing called rampancy, where she's basically going crazy. And there is, I mean, I don't want to exaggerate how affecting the story is, because this is not going to make anyone cry. Okay. It's not that great of a story, but there is a legitimate emotional attachment to this character and what she means to you, the player. And to see her break down psychologically over the course of the game is interesting, you know? Yeah. It's like, if you just did this with a random character, I wouldn't care. But because she's with you all the time, and she is very central to you playing the game, it does have an effect. But that does get to a complaint I have, and I don't know how the other Halo games compare. I can only really speak to Halo 4 in this case, because it's the only one I've played with Cortana. But she is very proactive in telling you where to go. So she puts markers on your HUD and says, go here. Yep. And every now and then, you either she goes away temporarily and you don't have that anymore, or the waypoint system in the game just gets a little technically screwed up and you no longer have that arrow showing you where to go. And when that happens, I felt totally lost.
Well, that's the interesting thing. I mean, they tried to kind of make it more, they kind of tried to sell it as more of, oh, it's more open world and you can kind of, you know, choose where you want to go, but you really can't. I mean, you know exactly where, you're told exactly where you want to go most of the time. And so even though they give you kind of a prettier sandbox to play in, you're still pretty much going in one direction through the entire game.
Yeah.
The areas that I didn't like were sometimes when they kind of force you to hop on, you know, some vehicle, and they kind of force you to like run through some gauntlet.
And, oh, we've talked about the vehicle stuff before,
yeah,
though.
Like, but this isn't the like controlling the warthog issue. This is like just where like you're tossed onto a spaceship and you have to run through some, you know, kind of like, you know, valley on a planet with stuff falling in front of you, and you have to go up above it and down below it. And, you know, it's kind of like some areas like in God of War where, like, you know, he's like flying upwards and, you know, you have to dodge stuff as it's coming towards you, and there's a lot of that. Which I felt was kind of clunky, and some of it was just frankly a pain in the ass. It was kind of there just to impede your progress, not really to like really do anything interesting.
It's like it's basically a pod race.
Yeah,
like we have this idea for a really exciting set piece scene in the game, and we really want to put the like our artists and the game directors really want to put this in there, but it's not really a part that you can play through with the normal gameplay mechanics. So we're going to give you minimal control over what happens, and we're going to turn it into essentially an interactive cutscene where there's only really one way to play through it. So if you don't do the right thing, you will fail. And so there's way too many fail states in these scenes, and you have to kind of figure out where they want you to go, which is to me is never a good thing in a video game where you're playing through a sequence and you're like, well, I'm getting really frustrated here. I'm dying over and over. Let me sit here and think about where do they want me to go? How can I do this in a way that will actually match up with their expectation? Because then I can just get past it.
Yep.
And there are a couple of scenes like that. But, you know, for the most part, I really enjoyed Halo 4. It is, to me, not a super innovative first-person shooter. And I don't even know that it's the best at what it does, at least for what I want out of a first-person shooter. It's not the most exciting. The combat is not the most interesting. The guns certainly are not the most interesting. In fact, a lot of the guns I found to be totally useless. So there's probably 15 guns in the game, and maybe 5 of them are extremely effective, but you'll hardly ever find them. They're super rare. So when you find them, you'll use them until they run out, and then you throw them away. And then there's like 2 that are really common and actually work. And those are the 2 that you will use 80% of the time, because all the other guns that they put out, all the alien pistols in the game are fucking shit.
Yeah, they're most of them are not useful, or they're just like, it's a shotgun with, you know, some kind of strange, you know, alien glow on it.
I don't understand why every weapon can't be really fun and satisfying to use, which is not to say they all have to be super powerful. They can have advantages and disadvantages and different use cases, but how about you make every gun feel cool and feel really fun to use? Because that is not the case in Halo 4, unfortunately.
But most shooters have this problem.
I know. It's very common, but
I think game designers do it because they want there to be like real tiers in the weapon design, if you to value some weapons up more than others. But the gun doesn't have to necessarily be great. It can just be kind of, I mean, there was, I'm trying to remember what game it was. There was a first person shooter for the PC in the early 90s. I'm blanking on the name, but somebody will probably remember it. It had a series of guns, about 4 or 5 out of the 20 or so, that were just hilariously awful. But like it was almost satisfying to use them, because if you got killed by them, you must suck.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I just found in Halo 4, if I have anything where I need to snipe, I just use the DMR, and if I have to fight something up close, I just use a shotgun. Anything else, I don't even bother with.
But when you're playing through the campaign, neither of those guns is very easy to come across.
Yeah, well, campaign and Spartan Ops. And Spartan Ops, they're all over the place because that's more of a drop you in an area and you have to kill your way out of it. So,
okay, so that's the co-op mode that David Ellis is heavily involved in. And John, you and I need to play some of that.
Yeah, that's actually really fun. It's pretty cool. In terms of a co-op mode, it's one of the best ones I've played.
We're going to check it out.
Yeah.
But for right now, we're going to chill until the next episode. Not really, until the break. And we'll be back in a minute with our predictions from 2012 and for 2013.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
This week we start off with a review of Family Party 30 Great Games Obstacle Arcade for the Wii U. The review is by Zach Kaplan. D3 Entertainment's party game collection is amazing. Stop listening right now and go buy it. Go! Are they gone? Good. If you knew enough about D3 to not go buy this game, congratulations on avoiding this entirely predictable mess of minigames.
We also have a review of Gunman Clyde on the 3DS eShop by Tyler Olu. We just talked about this retro masterpiece, and it turns out Tyler loves it too. Marrying the old and the new, Gunman Clive is the sheriff of the eShop.
You're welcome.
We have a blog, Nintendo Collector's Journal by Justin Berube. Ever see those Kinex renditions of Mario Kart Wii's carts? Justin owns them, and he's also wearing a plastic crown. I'm worried about him.
He's the sneak king.
No!
No!
Next up, we have a review for Marvel Avengers Battle for Earth by Alex Calafi. This is on the Wii U. It's Iron Man and his shitty friends, now rendered as a fighting game with Dutch angles. Shockingly, it isn't good.
Dutch angles? I don't even know what that means.
I don't either, but Iron Man and his shitty friends is fantastic.
It's an alternate title that was rejected late in the development stage.
And lastly, wanted to mention that Nintendo World Report is posting our top 10 favorite games of 2012. So go and disagree with us in the talkback threads. It's all over at NintendoWorldReport.com. Welcome back to the show, everyone. It is time to do our annual prediction segment where we make total asses out of ourselves. And we laugh at what big asses we were last year when we did this. And so we're going to start out with a recap from last year's predictions. These were what we thought would happen in the year 2012. And this should be a lot of fun to go through. I just want to give due credit to James, who went back and listened to the episode and wrote up a very detailed recap of all the dumb stuff that we predicted would happen. So we're going to go through and read off a couple of excerpts. And the way we're going to do it is we're going to go around and each one of us is going to read a couple of our favorites that we put out there last year. And Guillaume is going to do Greg's from last year. And then when we get done with the recap, we're going to do our new predictions for 2013, in which Guillaume will begin this wonderful tradition for himself. So I'll kick it off. And I guess one of the things I want to talk about, when we did this last year, it was before Wii U had been sort of reintroduced. No one had seen it since E3 of 2011. And there were a lot of questions about, is it going to get a new name? What are the launch titles? What is this new Mario game going to look like? Is anyone really going to care? What are they really going to do with the controller? We hadn't seen Nintendo Land at this point. We'd seen a couple of events from it, but we didn't know that the package itself existed. And so that was a big topic. And I predicted that the system will get a fairly significant facelift before launch and maybe a new name. Now, the console itself didn't really get a facelift, but I kind of partially hit on the controller getting a facelift.
It got a bit of one. I mean, it's not huge.
It's more not it doesn't look dramatically different than when we first saw it, but the features are fairly different than the version that they first showed.
Or it just
and
wasn't
the feel
done.
Of it is different.
Yeah.
So I think they delivered on that one. Unfortunately it did not get a new name, but That was just wishful thinking, I guess. And I predicted it'll cost $300 and include a game, but the game pack-in would not be Mario. So got fairly close on that one. I said that the last story was hopeless for a North American release. I'm very, very happy that I was wrong about that. We were all so shocked when XSEED picked up the publishing rights for that.
Yep.
It was just one of the strangest stories of the whole year. And then the fact that they released it and they did a great job releasing it, and it was a huge hit for them, like the biggest success they've ever had as a company.
It was.
And then they re-released it in a cheaper version so even more people can get a hold of it now. And I think it turned out to be probably one of the best games of the year. So I am thrilled to be wrong on that one. I'm so glad that it did finally come out in North America. And I said that E3, even though it would be kind of the big coming out party for Wii U, it would be dominated by 3DS games. And that was based on an experience we had on the DS back in 2007 mm-hmm. when the Wii was, or maybe it was 2006. It was the year the Wii came out, and there were a lot of Wii demos there, but they were kind of all stuck in this one part of Nintendo's booth. And outside of that, Wii was nowhere to be seen, but DS was everywhere. And I thought that would all play out over again in 2012. And unfortunately, although Wii U was very much restricted to Nintendo's booth and it was rarely seen outside of Nintendo's booth at other companies, unfortunately, 3DS did not have the widespread presence that I was hoping for from other publishers. There were games here and there. A lot of the ones that were shown at E3 were just kind of licensed games, or there were just things that weren't all that exciting. And the third-party support for 3DS did not materialize in 2012 the way I was hoping. And this year, I'm not sure that it's going to be much better. I haven't really seen the evidence of that, but it is certainly becoming the front runner. So maybe it's just an inevitability. Maybe all these publishers aren't necessarily excited about it, but they've seen, look, the future is not Vita, and it's probably not Shield either.
Oh my
God. And so if we're going to make portable games, they're going to be on 3DS. And so they may not make a big deal out of it, but maybe there will be 3DS games this year. I don't know. But I was certainly disappointed at the relatively diminished number and quality of 3DS games that we saw outside of Nintendo's booth at E3.
I was going to say, my favorite, though, is the one we didn't mention, which is that you predicted Xenoblade would bomb, and I suggested it was a conspiracy theory. Deliberately bombed the game.
Yeah, I've heard that it met Nintendo's expectations.
Yeah, whatever that means.
It's not saying much because they certainly didn't market it, and
no,
they certainly made it, you know,
impossible
not the
to
easiest
get.
Game to get. You know, you could only buy it at like two places, but I've heard that it did pretty well. Like, if you knew what Xenoblade was, you could go get it, and a lot of people did. Mm-hmm. So that's not the best news, but, you know, it's sad when XSEED published his last story and they probably sold more copies than Nintendo did for Xenoblade, but hey.
Yeah. Yeah.
At least both of the games came out, which is more than you can say for Pandora's Tower,
yes.
Which is really a lost cause.
Oh, that's done.
Yeah. It's not happening.
Forget that one. import.
Yeah.
So right. John's up next with his recap from 2012. From 2012.
All right. My predictions were that F-Zero, a new F-Zero title, was going to come to 3DS, obviously, and that it would be shown at E3. So I was really going balls out with this one. Did not
and
happen.
And Greg agreed with you.
Yeah,
I did agree, yes.
Not even close. I mean, it's just it's sad at this point.
Well,
they really just...
Johnny suggested Monster was going to make it, and Greg suggested Retro, and then Greg prevented me from making a Tube Sliders joke. So
Tube Sliders, he makes me giggle.
I think this one could still happen, and I still think Monster Games is the studio to make it happen.
Tube sliders. All right, and my second one was that Square Enix will be releasing Final Fantasy XIV for Wii U, and the joke there is, hey, they won't even be putting it out for PS3 or PC. Until next year. Sure didn't happen in 2012. That's just never going to happen. I could not be more wrong on that one.
That game is still coming out, though, even though
it's
already
coming
out. It's coming out again for PC.
Disaster. Yeah, it's about to go into
it's
beta.
It's coming out with the new subtitle, A Legend Reborn.
Yeah, or like, yeah, Realm Reborn. It's coming out for PS3
Reborn.
And PC, but not for Wii U. Yeah, Square Enix, they have their hands full with other platforms, let alone Wii U for that one. All right, and my third one was Steam would be announced for Wii U. Obviously, not going to happen. Especially with this whole Steam box that Valve is supposed to be coming out with. Obviously, they're just not going in that direction. So
right.
The PS3 thing was probably just an experiment on their part.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
I mean, it's in one game.
Yep. Yeah. Yep.
Steam on PS3 is in one game.
Yep.
So weird.
Yep.
I couldn't believe they never even released like a cross media bar application so that you could boot Steam up outside of Portal 3 or yeah. Portal 2.
Because then they could have done stuff like
sell you extra content or, you know, just let you see what your friends were doing outside of having to boot up that one game.
But yeah.
They never went there. I think it was totally just a weird experiment.
Well, is it more like the Ubisoft Uplay thing or what?
No, it's not even that. It's not even that.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, I guess when you boot the game up, it just asks you if you want to sign into Steam, right? That's all it does.
Yeah, yeah, that's all it does. It lets you play with PC players, which works really well.
Yeah.
But that's about all it does. It's really kind of stupid. All right, so Guillaume is up next with a recap of Greg's predictions.
Yeah, so Greg, it was more of a hope, really, less of a prediction, based on the gap between the games by Goodfeel. He thought that Goodfeel would produce a Yoshi game, perhaps in the style of Wario or Kirby Epic Yarn.
Which that's rumored that that's still going to happen, just not for Wii.
Yeah.
But that's a pretty strong rumor for 2013.
Yeah, there's been rumors, you know, based on the Future Shop website, snafus. It is through a Best Buy Canada website, which owns Future Shop, that people found out about the Wii Mini. So, who knows? Hmm. There might be truth, or it might just be bullshit. he's also predicted that WarioWare will be a big thing on 3DS or Wii U. And I don't know if it's going to be a big thing. Like, the Wario game that we're getting is not even going to be a WarioWare game. It's more of a collection of minigames, right?
So, the recent stuff from the late December Nintendo Direct in Japan, it's all the WarioWare characters are in it in their WarioWare regalia. So
yeah, but that doesn't necessarily make it a WarioWare game. I mean, the characters are there.
It's more of a spin-off of WarioWare.
I just wonder, based on all that, if they're starting to tilt it back towards more WarioWare stuff. They're kind of transitioning it away because what they wanted it to be, they don't feel like it's working out for.
Hmm. Interesting. Next prediction, he thought that Pikmin was going to be a launch window title for the Wii U. Back then, did we even know about Pikmin 3?
We did.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So he said it may or may not make it into this calendar year, first few months. So I guess this was correct.
Well, I don't know, if it comes out in June, does Nintendo still consider that the launch window?
Nintendo does.
Maybe the launch doorway.
At least according to the 3DS, that's launch window.
It's a bay window,
Johnny. Everything before launch window.
It's a bay window.
And James went all out and said that all of Nintendo's games would have some form of online content.
I emphasized really hard the phrase some form, though. So
well, technically, I guess they all have Miiverse, so I guess technically you're correct.
Well, and I did say explicitly, I didn't mean necessarily gameplay.
You will play them on your Wii U, which is sitting next to your PC, which can connect to the internet.
in the context of the conversation, I'm going to take credit on that one for Miiverse.
All right, yeah, sure. You predicted Miiverse.
I invented the Miiverse. Nintendo, you know where to send my royalty checks. You can send them in Nintendo points.
Yep.
And finally, Greg had a prediction for E3, which has been proven wrong a couple of months ago, which was that we were going to get a somewhat bullshitty, quote-unquote, Smash Brothers teaser means. Trailer.
That's probably going to happen this year.
Yeah,
well, probably.
Johnny's commentary, though, on that game might be further along because Kid Icarus Took the Sun came out because Sakurai left because he said, oh shit, this thing's going to go bad.
Yeah, apparently Kid Icarus just took a long time because it's a surprisingly long game.
Yeah.
And it had a lot of stuff in it. I guess that's why it took so long to make Kid Icarus.
Yeah.
So,
that's it for Greg.
Yep. So for my stuff, I predicted that the Wii U would have online, which is not a big bold prediction. And that new Super Mario Brothers Wii and U, which I was calling it at the time, quote, almost has to at this point. They can't just have another new Super Mario Brothers. Apparently they can. But as a caveat to that, I did predict that the tablet will allow one player to, quote, dick around, which we were about 6 minutes into predictions at that point, and it was the first one we had been successful on. Go yep. us.
Yep.
I did say there'd be some Wii Sports pack in, but it wouldn't be online. And you know, it depends if you want to count my other one.
Yeah, that kind of contradicts with your claim for Miiverse, right?
And let's see. I said that the eShop is going to this. Oh, is it this year? This is the year the eShop is going to go well, which is the worst sentence ever constructed. And then followed it up with the completely wrong statement that this is the first Miyamoto design game will be on the eShop, and that there will be lots of tablet tools on the Wii U eShop. So I whiffed on that entire list.
The Miyamoto thing might happen in 2013. I mean, I think they're signaling that pretty strongly. You know, he's got his own little team, and they're working on a smaller game, and they want it to be some kind of new IP. That could very easily become an eShop exclusive game on either system.
Yeah. And I also predicted that this would be the first games that would make good use of AR, which we went on this little tirade that ended with Johnny suggesting maybe a Fatal Frame kind of thing. Which, what the, how the fuck did he get that one?
Oh, man.
I almost fell over listening to this episode when I got, I'm like, what the, what? I had to go back because I stopped typing for a good 2 minutes just going, what the hell just happened?
It's very spooky that I would predict that.
Mm-hmm. No. no, no. Anyway. although these aren't predictions, I would like to point out that our looking forward to thing did not go well because many of the games we were looking forward to didn't come out.
Yeah, so we ended the prediction segment with a sort of just a brainstorming of like the games that we're the most excited about that actually exist, that had actually been announced at the time.
My favorite one here, though, is Greg was looking forward to Luigi's Mansion and Code of Princess, which he felt, if it got localized, would presumably get a better name.
Hey, why try?
I wonder if Greg ended up playing Code of Princess.
Did it come out?
I don't think it's out in Europe yet, but yeah, it's going to be.
Right. It just got a release date, didn't it?
Yeah, it's got a release date for the eShop. It's not going to be at physical retail.
Yep.
And poor Greg, he was looking forward to Rocket Slime 3. That is nowhere to be seen.
No. Nope. Yeah, Greg more or less had a bad go, but the only game he was looking forward to that actually came out was Revelations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was like 3 months later. Yeah. So John was looking forward to Xenoblade Chronicles, which I'm sure you have not played, John.
Oh, I've played through it 3 or 4 times. Thank you very much.
That was your most anticipated game of 2012.
I played enough of it.
Did you buy a copy?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You
I
did?
Got a copy of it. Yeah.
He talked about it on the show.
I threw in about 10 hours, let me say that.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah.
You know what? That's totally respectable.
Yeah.
So James was excited about the last story. Very, very well-reasoned choice there. And Virtue's Last Reward and Leighton versus Phoenix Wright.
Didn't come out.
Are you still excited about the Time Travelers?
I haven't seen much about it lately, so I don't know. Leighton versus Wright I'm still excited about. But the Time Travelers, I'll probably play the Time Travelers when it comes out, because Level 5 has had such a high hit ratio for me that at this point I give them the benefit of the doubt.
I think Danny said on the Famicast that there's a demo of it in Japan.
I think there is, yeah.
But I don't think the game is out yet.
No, they've been doing that lately in Japan with demos months and months in advance.
Yeah. And then the game I was looking forward to is Pikmin 3.
Oh.
I'm still looking forward to it, especially Miyamoto recently was quoted as saying that he wanted to bring back the kind of stress that was part of the first Pikmin and that they had taken out of the second one, which is the main reason I prefer the first Pikmin.
Mm. It's funny because the reaction on the internet was so negative and people were like, oh, fuck time limits. And everyone loves Majora's Mask. So what the hell?
Because Majora's Mask is a good game. There you go.
Well, Pikmin 1 is as well.
It's not as good.
When you put those time constraints on there, it forces you to play in a way that you would not if you didn't have the time limit. And it doesn't work for every game. Time limits don't always make a game better. But in the case of Pikmin, I thought it was pretty clear between the first and the second game that the first was better. And it was better because you couldn't just dick around as much as you wanted. You had an ultimate goal and you had to keep moving towards it. And you're exploring and you're trying different things out along the way, but ultimately you need to find a solution quickly. and it forces you to play in an efficient way and to find good ways to solve problems. And the second game is just, it's too freeform.
Yeah, you can brute force it because you've got all the time in the world. You can just raise Pikmin and then, you know, go get that one object and save and then go back the next day.
And more importantly, Pikmin 2 is leveraged too heavily on these underground levels where you can't make new Pikmin. Mm-hmm. And the levels are kind of randomly generated. And I don't really like that stuff. I wanted more of the puzzle-oriented, big world kind of levels that were in the first game. The second one has them too, but ultimately they're kind of a small fraction of the game. So I'm hoping that that they also go back that way with a third one. But at this point, who can say? We still don't know that much about Pikmin 3. After all this time, I've played it, and I still don't feel like I really know what that game does differently than Pikmin 2. So I'm still looking forward to it, kind of. And then we asked Greg over email, we asked if he had any commentary on reading through this recap, and he certainly was entertained by it. Greg just asked me to pass along this quote. I know everyone will be super excited to hear any word from Greg Leahy. So Greg says, quote, "Reflecting on last year's predictions, it is clear that I got out at the right time. Have fun, guys." End quote. Yeah. In other words, Greg agrees we did a bad job last year. But we always do a bad job. That's why people like the segment, I guess. So it's time to get into our new predictions for 2013. And James, since you spent the work to develop this recap that we just went over, I figure why don't you go first?
Sure. So, first one. I'm predicting that one of the major localization houses for Japanese games, so like Exeed, Atlas, one of those.
Level 5?
Maybe not level 5, actually. But one of those companies, the Atlas, Nipponichi, Axis, you know, those kinds of ones, that they will begin to forego releasing their retail games as retail games and will begin to publish them exclusively on the eShop. And that in so doing, they will actually see much better return on investment.
But don't you think that goes against the traditional niche success that these companies have, which is releasing these kind of collector's editions of these Japanese games?
They may release a handful. I mean, Atlas games are already a handful, but like it may be that they only release these like really niche collector's editions, and that every other sale, and that their expected mode of sale is eShop.
Yeah, they can always do that, like just sell stuff like that from their website only.
Yeah.
So that's true. And they have to deal with retail.
Some of these companies already have a history of doing both at the same time on PSN.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, Atlas is very present on PSN.
And Atlas is releasing Coda Princess on 3DS.
Exceed just released Unchained Blades solely on the eShop.
Yeah, Level 5, although I didn't think they're going to be the ones to do it. Level 5, you know, Guildo 1, they just parted out as eShop games outside of Japan.
God bless them.
I think they'll still continue to release retail copies of their games in Japan. I think just localizing, they're so niche, they'll become eShop-only games.
Yeah.
I also think that this is Nintendo's year of the Pokemon. Now, you might say, well, what does that mean? Black and White sold 16 million copies worldwide. Black and White 2 sold 6, which is a lot of copies. But I think right now,
but it's a lot less.
Well, it's not been out as long either, and it's a sequel. True. And it came out after the 3DS.
Mm-hmm.
What I think is going to happen, rather, is that they have Pokemon XY coming out, and it's the first 3D game, like real polygonal 3D. I think this is the year that Nintendo musters its marketing strength to try to launch the Pokemon. It's kind of a relaunch of the Pokemon's periphery branding content. I think this is the year they try to repush, you know, everything from the show, the toys, just a much bigger
airplanes.
Media presence. Yeah, a much. I think a much bigger Western media push than any of the more recent Pokemon games ever seen.
All right, how about this? How about they try to bring back? I don't know that it ever went away. What if they try to relaunch the Pokemon trading card game as an iPhone app?
I mean,
seriously, they kind of already pushed, you know, a little bit in this direction. And Nintendo is never going to make real games for iPhone, but no. like their investors want them to. But no. I do think they're and Iwata's been quoted very recently as saying that they are willing to leverage these smartphone platforms as a way to supplement their primary systems where they sell the real games. And that seems like a perfect way to do it. They can make a shit ton of money doing Pokemon trading cards on iPhone.
I think it's going to be I don't think I'll be able to point to any one part of the Pokemon brand they're going to push. I think they're going to try to repush everything. I think with the games getting a full graphical makeover like they've never had before, they're going to view this as the time to introduce the youngest generation to these games and to all the accoutrements that go with them.
They certainly have a chance to reintroduce me to Pokemon.
Yeah.
Because X and Y looks like they actually are trying, finally, after 10 years of making the same crap over and over again. And it may play the same way, but at least it looks different.
I also think that this is my third one. I think that this is the year that Koizumi and possibly Shimizu's EAD groups have their next Mario game to show at E3. And I could say that because they co-produced 3D Land, and that came out almost it'll be about 2 years come the holiday season. Mm-hmm. They co-produced it with Brownie Brown, so they've had time to develop a game, and I think it's time for the Wii U to get its 3D Mario game. And I think we'll probably see it at E3 this year.
But will it actually come out, or will it be delayed?
I think their stated goal will be for it to come out.
Okay.
What I don't think, though, is I don't think they're going to counter-program with a Zelda game. So I think if we get a Mario, we don't get a Zelda, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And that would be my three.
Cool. Guillaume, why don't you lay out your first ever predictions for Radio Free Nintendo?
All right, so in order to maximize the chances of being right, I have to be as vague as possible, right? So I think that we're going to finally see Retro's game. I think it's going to be a Metroid 2 prequel. And I think it's going to be a squad-based shooter where you play a member of the Galactic Federation Marines sent to the planet to eradicate the Metroids, and who were never heard back from again.
It's incredibly vague.
So you're saying it's going to start as a squad base, but over the course of the game, all the other people other than Samus go missing or are killed?
Oh, Samus is not in this game.
She'll be an NPC.
Wait, are you saying you're playing one of the...
This is Metroid Reach.
Are you saying you're playing one of the soldiers that's lying dead on the ground at the start of Metroid Prime 3?
No, but I'm talking about like the Game Boy game, Metroid 2.
Oh, Metroid 2. Oh, but they probably did. Who knows?
Yeah. Anyway, I do, like, you know, I was kind of kidding. Like, I made this way too precise. But I do think that their game is going to be way closer to a traditional first-person shooter than any of their other games before it.
I can tell you what they didn't send in Metroid 2. A fucking camera that can zoom out.
But yeah, I think it's definitely going to be in first person. It's going to look great and everything. But it's going to be even more shooty than Metroid Prime 3.
So they're going to make it more like Halo.
Maybe.
Because Halo 4 really does look like a Metroid Prime game. It really does, but it doesn't play like Metroid Prime.
What about Republic Commando, which obviously has quite a large number of Metroid Prime influences, but is also a squad-based shooter? And to be honest, the Republic Commandos are pretty much the same thing as the Federation soldiers.
Well, I've never played those games, but yeah, like the whole squad-based thing, I wasn't really thinking of a multiplayer game. I picture it more like a kind of an alien type of thing.
Yeah, I mean, the Republic Commando is a good example because it really isn't multiplayer. There are four members of your squad, and they're all different, and they all have skills and stuff, and I guess in your case, they all get killed because Guillaume hates your friends.
This isn't what Guillaume specifically predicted, but I would like a variation on that where it is you do start with a squad, and one of them is Samus. So you start out and you're thinking, damn it, they're doing that thing from Prime 3 where they put all these dumb characters in there. But over the course of the game, all the other characters get killed off one by one. And so by the end of it, it's turned into a traditional Metroid game where you're the only one left. And because you've gone through this process, everything is way creepier and more foreboding than ever before. I could, I mean, that would be cool. I'm not saying that's going
to
happen.
Do we get
that
to
would
hear
cool.
about the baby?
I'm not even thinking about like a whole lot of Metroid elements.
So you're thinking it's set in the universe, but that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
In that case, would it be, I mean, I could see them making a more populist modern first person shooter, but in that case, I think they might just forego the whole Metroid franchise and just try to create some new IP.
Let's move on to the next prediction. This year, Nintendo has released 5 Mario games.
They released a few more.
From Mario Party 9 to New Super Mario Bros. U. So I think they're going to go a little bit less heavy on the Mario this year. And I originally wrote 3, but I think 2. Like a maximum of 2 Mario titles.
Just 2 Mario titles.
2 games with the word Mario in the title.
Yeah. That does not include Luigi's Mansion.
Okay.
I think that what we're going to see probably this year are Mario Kart, which would be a priority for Nintendo.
Yeah.
They want to get that out as quickly as possible because it's going to sell for years to come. I'm not sure if we're going to see a 3D platformer. I'm really not sure. I think it's a little bit too early. I think that perhaps we're going to see some Mario Sports title. Perhaps, this is not really part of my prediction, perhaps they're going to make it, you know, a sport that's really well adapted to the tablet, such as Mario Curling, with sweeping action on the touchscreen.
Available only in Canada.
Mario Curling.
It's gonna come with the Wii Mini.
Yeah, it only plays on the Wii Mini.
But only in Canada. If you cross into Detroit, that thing self-destructs.
But I think some sort of Mario... Well, although now I'm saying basically 2 Mario games on the Wii U, so maybe I want to fix that prediction. We're going to see one... Like, we're going to see Mario Kart on the Wii U and something on 3DS. Mm-hmm. And... All right. Well, my third prediction is pretty close to what James already predicted. I think that the kind of dearth of 3DS games at last E3 is just going to go on. It's not going to get really much better, at least for the American publishers. I don't see them. I don't see the indifference stopping anytime soon. I do think it's going to be a very big year for Atlus and Exceed. I think that we can't really expect much from Capcom other than Monster Hunter. I think they're going to stay safe again.
Ignore Mega Man, you bastards.
Yeah. When you think back of the DS, like, Capcom was a lot more experimental with what they released initially.
Yeah.
And then it was just like Ace Attorney games.
But Capcom had a bad year in 2012.
In general,
it did.
Yeah.
And right. They earned it. They earned every bit of that bad year.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, so I do think that they're experimental. Like, they tried Resident Evil on their 3DS. They tried Street Fighter, which was a success, but I think they're going to kind of retreat back to the safe stuff like Monster Hunter on 3DS and not really release anything else. So that's going to leave the way more open for Atlus and Exceed to become, like, two probably... It's strange to say, but two of the biggest publishers for 3DS outside of Nintendo.
But you don't mean in terms of like numbers of copies sold, but in terms
I mean like in number of releases.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, okay. And what frustrates me about, I mean, to the Capcom point is we know they have a really cool game that's in Japan. They're just not going to release here because they're stubborn.
EX Troopers.
Yeah. Which apparently is great, but fuck you if you don't live in Japan.
Yep.
I think that could... I think there's a chance that, like, maybe it's... I think it's about 50-50, that game coming out in the West.
I mean, I just don't know what else they're going to release. I mean, they've pretty much... If it's not Monster Hunter, they've pretty much said, eh. But, you know, EX Troopers does have a lot of things in common with Monster Hunter, so it's...
They are stupid if they don't make a Mega Man for 3DS.
They are stupid, though. That's the problem. Mm-hmm.
There
we
is
know.
Clearly a demand for it. There's clearly a demand for it. And that's the cheapest place they can make it and make it good.
How many eShop games are there that are Mega Man clones at this point?
Yeah, plenty. I mean, if you know, count Mighty Switch Force and Mutant Muds and Gun
Clive. I would
count
Mighty Switch Force if it was as good as the worst Mega Man game, but it isn't. I'm looking at you, Mega Man 8.
Yeah, it's just that when you look at Xseed, they did use... I think that... What was their biggest year for DS?
Oh, this year... This is... I mean, for DS, about 2 years ago, they had a few games in a row. I think I reviewed like three of them.
I think they had a whole bunch of stuff like in 2010, but then they moved more and more towards PSP.
They did.
But now, like, PSP is, you know, you don't, it's really done. And, like, they don't really have anywhere else to go to but 3DS. Like, they're not going to move to the Vita.
No one's going to move to the Vita.
No.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
They're going to move away from it.
Yeah, 2011, they had Solitarobo. They had, oh, crap. They had about three other games, which for them, to release four games in a year for them is huge. I mean, it's a tiny company.
Yeah, yeah. So I do think that the only thing, like, we're going to get a lot of announcements from them this year. They're just, like, waiting for Japanese developers to make some RPGs before they can announce localizing them.
It's going to happen, though. 3DS has turned out to be a huge hit in Japan, and the RPGs are in the pipeline, I'm telling you.
But, like, Axis is another company that's done really well, just bringing over, you know, a handful of niche games for the 3DS platform or for Vita, PSP, or whatever system you want to talk about. I mean, that's their entire business model at this point.
Yeah.
Is they pick out niche Japanese game and pay nothing for it, localize it, do a decent job localizing it, and sell it.
They're working designs. I love that the legacy of working designs lives on in companies that do a better job of it than they ever did. But the thing is, I mean, working designs, if you're not familiar with them, they were a publisher in the 90s who brought over awesome, obscure Japanese games and had this boutique publishing industry where they would make these lavish collector's editions of games like Lunar and some of the treasure games, some of the shooters. And they eventually started running into problems where they were over-localizing games or trying to change them too much. They were tweaking gameplay. They were, you know, just getting into a bunch of bad business deals. But at the time, there was no one else doing anything close to that. Mm-hmm. And I love that now there are multiple companies essentially doing the exact same thing, but they're doing a better job of it, and they're doing it in a way that they can sustain as a business and keep going. I love it. And they're competing with each other, which makes them better at what they do.
And one of the things about those, I'd say there's about four companies that are involved in it right now, is that they do compete with each other, but they're very actively engaged with their fan bases.
Mm-hmm.
They run very active social media campaigns, but they're also actively engaged with each other's fan bases. Like, they'll speak well of each other's games if there's one, like, when Tales of the Sky came out, like, some of them were like, oh, I wish we had gotten that game. I think the reason that companies like this are able to be successful is because the people they hire don't just care about games, but care about these games.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
When we went, so I guess I was the only person here who went to it, but a handful of us went to Xseed's office in 2011 during right before E3. And one of the things they said, and they've said it before and they've said it since then, is that when they have a game that they bring in to decide if they want to do it, they vote on it. As a company, they vote, do we want to do this game? It's not just like, hey guys, we got a cheap license, let's do it. They really care about the work they're doing. And that, I think that you can really tell the difference. I think
it's awesome.
That's what makes it good, and that's what gives you a good hope that games that, like, these companies bring over are going to be good, or at least they're going to be decent. And Ragnarok Online DS game.
Right, so, Guillaume, did you have any other predictions?
Nope, that was it.
Cool. All right, I'm going to run through mine. This is similar but different to something you said, Guillaume. I think this year we are going to hear about Retro Studios' new game. I don't think anyone is even going to argue that. We have to hear about what Retro Studios is doing. I think that game will be Metroid Prime 4. They might put a different subtitle on it, but it will effectively be Metroid Prime 4. And the world will rejoice, and I will be there with them.
Except for me.
Except for James. But I will rejoice. I think, I think Other M was an admirable experiment that failed in some ways. It's not a bad game. It's easy to laugh about it. Lots of hilarious things about that game, but it is a good game, and I enjoyed it for what it is, but it is nowhere close to as good as the Metroid Prime series. And I think, after doing Donkey Kong and some track designs for Mario Kart, I think Retro is probably ready to jump back into a big, meaty, complicated, more mature kind of game. And there's a lot of other places, and they probably have been experimenting over the past couple years.
I would hope
probably
so.
Probably some of those experiments didn't work out, and probably some of them will turn into ideas that will be manifest in the new Metroid Prime game. But I think that's what we're going to see, and I think Nintendo will feel strongly, whether right or wrong, but they will feel strongly that announcing a new Metroid Prime in HD for the Wii U is really going to change the fortunes of that system. We'll see if it works out, but I do think that game will be announced. And while I'm announcing games in the future, I think Final Fantasy 15 is going to be announced, and it's coming to 3DS. It may not be exclusive to 3DS. It might even come out on Vita. It might be this kind of multi-platform thing, but I think it will be for 3DS, maybe in addition to other systems.
I would say they haven't even finished the second half of the 13 duo. What is it, 13 Versus or whatever they're calling it? Mm-hmm.
But that game is okay. So 13 Versus probably canceled at this point. Mm-hmm. And
who knows?
They're wrapping up the third Final Fantasy 13.
Why?
Well, because they're milking that engine. They spent millions and millions and millions on that engine.
That's where I was going, though. They built this really fucking expensive engine that they had to make two games. They fought just to cover it. Mm-hmm. And then one of those games goes in development hell for almost a decade. And then they start making sequels to a game that everybody's kind of about to begin with.
James,
I think that the cost of making those games is what makes your prediction most likely.
Yeah.
Or more likely.
And here's the other piece to it. In Japan, 3DS just surpassed PS3 lifetime sales.
Yes.
Making a game where PS3 or even PS4 is the lead platform in Japan, no CEO can look at the install base for these systems and tell me that it's a good idea to make an incredibly expensive, risky proposition Final Fantasy sequel on the new super expensive HD system versus 3DS, which already has a huge fan base in Japan.
And you know they're not making it for the next Xbox.
No.
The Xbox is home of awesome strategy RPG games where you have to mate with your counterparts in order to produce the upcoming generations.
Yes, sign me up.
Fine.
I think FF13 did fine on mm-hmm. 360 in the West. but I really do think if they want to continue making mainline numbered Final Fantasy games, and they do, they're going to get FF14 relaunched, which is very important to their corporate pride and their and ultimately their bottom line, because they can make money on that game if they actually do it right. They are looking forward to the next numbered Final Fantasy game, and it'll probably be called 15 because fuck it at this point. And I really think this will be a portable game. It might be 3DS and Vita, but it will definitely be on 3DS.
It's going to be called 8-2. It's going to have nothing to do with Final Fantasy 8.
I think we might see some kind of new trailer for Zelda on Wii U at E3. And when we do, it might have a new art style that will look a lot different than the sort of realistic Zelda trailer that they showed last year. Really, that was 2 years ago.
It was 2 years ago because I was there.
Yeah.
It's 2011.
They really didn't say anything about Zelda last year, did they? So I think they have been working on that, and I think they might show a trailer for it. But I think the 3DS Zelda is going to come first, and that will be a much bigger focus than the Wii U one. And I think the 3DS Zelda might be some kind of revival or revisit to Link's Awakening, because Link's Awakening is one of the most beloved Zelda games. You know, you can't argue with that. There's just tons of people who still say it's their favorite.
We had a 3-minute
debate
about it last week about whether or not Marin's an interesting character. So go ahead.
There you go. So bring her back. I think it's not going to be called Link's Awakening 2, but it will be very
clearly... Get the fuck up, Link. God, it's almost noon.
I think it will be very clearly some kind of spiritual successor to Link's Awakening, because that's also a game that people directly associate with playing on a portable system.
Yep.
And it will recapture some version of the art style, you know, but of course updated. And people will get super excited about it.
Will it keep the semi-goofiness of that game? I mean, there's a lot of goofy stuff in Link's Awakening.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Zombie blue flying chickens.
Yeah. Whereas the Wii U one might look like Wind Waker. It might look like something totally different. But I think we're going to see less of the console game, because that's probably still a 2014 game. I think the 3DS game is a 2013 game. That's one of the big holiday games for 2013. And we will definitely hear about that.
Top down?
Year. I think Dragon Quest X will finally come to the West. It's not going to be a huge deal, unfortunately. It's just going to be kind of a secondary, you know, second tier game release. Nintendo will probably publish it themselves, because Square are really cowardly about publishing Dragon Quest games in the West. But it will come out eventually. You know, it's coming out very soon in Japan for Wii
U.
And of course, Nintendo of America is waiting for the Wii U version, because it certainly doesn't make sense to release the Wii version at this point. So they're waiting for that one, and then they're going to start localizing it. It'll probably come out before the end of the year. And finally, I think Wii U will be fairly slow in the West in 2013. It had a strong enough start, but there's not enough super exciting stuff on the horizon to keep that system selling well. And I think it's gonna see a significant sales slump, but it will be pretty strong in Japan. I think it will be surprisingly strong in Japan, because I think people in Japan are not really waiting for PS4. They certainly don't give a shit about the new Xbox. and the Wii, although Wii was maybe relatively more popular in the West than it ever was in Japan, just because of the whole console versus handheld thing, Wii was still a huge hit in Japan. And I think Nintendo in Japan, they have a little more license to find ways to market it and make it a more of a mainstream success. Whereas in America, they're going to have a more difficult time, and Europe, they're going to have a more difficult time making people understand why they would want a Wii U. But in Japan, because of the way Japanese households are set up and the way people play games there locally, they're going to have more success there. And Wii U is going to do really well in Japan, which ultimately is good for the rest of the world too, as games go into development in order to support that region and then eventually filter elsewhere. So that's my last prediction.
I've got one more just for the sake of that then. We're going to get to hear all about the Japanese exchange rate in press releases.
Sweet.
Right, probably about end of March. It's going to early April. We're going to hear all about the value of the yen. So, John, you're last up, man.
All right. I think my first one, I think that we're going to see Wii Music U announced at E3.
Wii Music.
Wii Music. Yep, I think it's going to be, I think they're going to use Miiverse to, you know, get people sharing their stuff that they create.
That could be kind of cool.
Yeah, I think it's going to actually be an improvement on the series, possibly. I think with what Wii U can do, I think they can actually make it into something more than just a glorified toy. They can actually make it more of an experience.
I actually think that we might see something closer to Mario Paint.
Ooh.
You know, it would have tools for music, but it would also be mostly for drawing.
Yeah. I like that. I like that a lot.
Yeah, I think we're going to see kind of more of a focus from Nintendo on sharing what you create, you know. Kind of something, because that's something that's really not being done elsewhere. You know, I mean, Sony and Microsoft are definitely kind of, you know, they have games that do it, but really they don't do it on a kind of platform level.
Right. I mean, their platforms aren't built to do it.
Yeah. Yep. So I think that's one thing we're going to see. Also, I think we're going to see kind of a streamlined Wii U gamepad announced at E3, maybe with some better battery life.
See, I think that's of 2014. I think you're on the mark, but I think it's too early for that.
Yeah. Yep.
You're too prescient.
Too far ahead of my time. Well, maybe. How's about this? How's about that will be announced by the end of the year? Maybe not E3.
I could see that, especially in that weird that week after Christmas when Japan really likes to announce giant shit.
Here's a Nintendo Direct that you probably wish you knew about a week ago.
Yeah.
Oh, all right. Fuck you too.
I think that we'll see Modern Warfare 4 announced for Wii U. That's not really too much of a reach at all, but I think that's going to be coming. I think Black Ops 2 did well enough. It actually sold, compared to how many Wii U's were actually out there on the market at the time, it actually did pretty well. I think it sold to about 8% of Wii U's out there compared to like about 10% of Xbox 360s. Of course, Xbox 360, massive user base, but I mean, I was actually surprised. At first, I assumed that it had sold very well, Black Ops 2, but actually, you know, it actually sold pretty well on Wii U, comparatively for the size of the install base.
Yeah.
And keep in mind, getting, that may not seem like a huge percent, but any game that gets that kind of percent that's not a Nintendo game is considered a victory.
Yeah. Yep. That's big, and I mean, that's what third parties want to see, right? I mean, they don't really care. They just want to see, you know, they just want to see copies fly off the shelves. They don't really, you know, that's all they care about. So that was good. I was actually happy to see that. My other prediction that I will not plan on buying Pokemon X or Y, but I will buy it after being pressured by Carly Young.
To be fair, you weren't really pressured. It was more like, John, you should totally buy this. And you're like, I'm not going to buy that. And then you caved.
Yes.
And you caved so shamefully, you did it before we woke up in the morning.
I did. I went to the nearest.
In the dark of night, he snuck away buy the game.
I went to Target and, yeah.
The wee hours of the morning.
Yeah. Yep.
That's not being pressured. That was more like having no self-control.
That is true. I've been known to not have self-control, that's for sure. I'm also with Johnny in predicting Metroid Prime 4 or perhaps a new trilogy. I'm not really too sure exactly what they're going to do with it.
They may not call it 4, but it will be effectively 4.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's going to be
they're going to call it a trilogy.
I think there's going to be more focus on the online component. I think there will be online multiplayer of some sort. I feel like it almost is kind of this. I feel like it almost kind of has to at this point, because I feel like other first-person shooters have stepped up their campaigns to the point where, you know, Metroid really should have some sort of online multiplayer. And it also keeps people coming back and, you know, in terms of being able to monetize a game, it seems to work pretty well for Call of Duty. So, but yep, that's what I got.
Very cool. All right, guys. Well, those are our predictions for 2013, and that's going to wrap up the segment. So I do want to remind everyone that we're going to be doing our games of the year next week, our top five games of 2012. Those will be personal lists. Each one of us will do our own top five. And I'm really looking forward to hearing about that, especially from John.
Hey.
Did you play five games in 2012?
I'm telling you, my top
did
five.
Did you play
all,
games in 2012?
All Atari 2600 games.
Fuck.
Starting number one, Combat.
Oh, my. No.
Combat is the best.
It is.
No doubt.
It is.
It is the best. Yeah.
Kaboom might be on there as well.
Kaboom.
Yeah, so I'm very excited for that. I've been cramming. I've been trying to play a couple things, and that's going to be a good discussion. We aren't planning to do emails within the next couple weeks, probably, because we're going to be doing the retroactive live very soon after that. But you never know. We're not told. We don't have the schedule completely nailed down yet. So just to be safe, you should probably send in an email to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We would love to hear what you thought of our predictions. Next week, we'd love to hear what you thought about our picks for games of the year. And, of course, you should be playing Majora's Mask and be ready for that, because that is coming up faster than you think. It's been probably a little more delayed than I originally expected, but I think it's all going to work out beautifully to do it in late January. Now that we've got John back on here, we're going to try to get Billy on for that show, and we're going to try to convince Guillaume that he's actually having fun playing it.
And, if I play the Song of Time backwards, do I have a month to play through it?
No. Get your ass in gear.
You've had 2 months to play through it. Also, before we go, I wanted to throw out a quick pitch. We got an email from our friend Pete. He has written into the show. He's a very long-time listener, and he is organizing an event to raise money for Child's Play, which obviously we fully support. And Pete and some of his buddies are doing a thing called Tales of Charity, and they're playing as a marathon. They're playing through the entirety of Tales of Symphonia for GameCube, which is a wonderful game. Lots of fans here on the show and probably among the audience as well of Tales of Symphonia. And they are trying to raise money. So you can find them at Tales of Charity on Twitter, or go to facebook.com/Tales of Charity. And we will put links to those in the show article. So if you're a fan of Tales of Symphonia, or if you just want to support a great charity and get involved with a cool event there, definitely look into that stuff. And we thank Pete for letting us know about it. That event is taking place between January 18th and January 20th. So it's coming up pretty soon after this podcast goes up. So please don't delay. Go check out the links to that and find out more about it. And please support those guys. And please support Child's Play. So that's all for this week. I thought it was a great reintroduction of John Lindemann. Okay. And we're looking forward to having you back again next week, John.
It's good to be back, Johnny.
Alrighty. So that's it for all of us here on Radio Free Nintendo, and we'll see you next time. Bye.
Later.
Later.
Bye.
They find that he is either unable or unwilling to provide additional granularity as to why that is his desire.
Granularity.
Yes.
I had to stop you because people were making fun of you last week when you said that.
Sorry. Don't care. It's
granular.
Fine.
I'm saving you from
additional... Granularity.
Fine.
I'm going to edumacate you on the granularity.
Edumacate, yeah. You sound like Don King.
Great.
It's going to be the most granular fight ever.
It will be. Fine. He refuses to provide or is unable to provide additional details as to why this is what he desires.